Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by Joe Hudson. Joe is a highly sought after executive coach, coaching CEOs and leaders in prominent companies in Silicon Valley and around the world. And he runs transformative programs for individuals and businesses. You can find his work at the Art of Accomplishment, an online learning platform for personal development. They have a fantastic podcast there as well as some very juicy looking trainings. And today we're going to get right into Joe's work as a coach. How does he view what it takes to do the kind of work he does, this deep transformational work? What's the transformational journey that he's been on in order to do the depth of the work that he does? And what kinds of moves does he make with his clients? We'll also be exploring some of the challenges that Joe is making to coaches and those in the field. For me, this is a conversation I'll certainly be coming back to listen to again. I learned a lot from Joe. You can head to coachesrising.com to find out more about our online trainings and other things that we create. And without further ado, here's the podcast with Joe Hudson. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Joe, I'm really excited to be with you today. And well, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It has been a whirlwind recently. Everything is growing so quickly that it feels like driving a motorcycle without goggles on at high speeds. So it's like, it's exhilarating and awesome and definitely overwhelming. Yeah.
When you say growing, are you talking about all the work you're bringing into the world and to people engaged inside of that?
Yeah. All of our courses are selling out. You know, for a long time I've had a sold out practice, but yeah, everything else, the online stuff that we're putting together and and what's happening in the companies that I coach. It's pretty much everywhere across the board. There's just a lot of growth movement happening.
Before we talk about what you do as a coach, I'm just curious, why do you think that is? Why do you think it's exploding? I mean, sometimes things just have that natural uptick, but do you think there's something else going on? Or?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's definitely a lot of, we put a lot of stuff out there for a long period of time. And so there's just a certain amount of traction that comes with it. So there came an earlier time in my life when I realized that the only way that I could ever market anything was to teach. And the only way that, and the only thing marketing could ever be is teaching and what I'm doing. So I really veered away from how do I get people attracted to, I'm just going to teach. I'm just going to do the, I'm just going to share the stuff that I have to share and then see what happens. And I found so much joy in that. Just switching that mindset from the idea of selling to the idea of just sharing. And what's interesting is that the more that I've learned all the skill sets of marketing, the more those marketing skill sets have actually helped in coaching, have actually helped in my capacity to teach. So it's a very intricate, or not intricate, it's a very virtuous cycle. But I really enjoy that part of it. I enjoy the kickback that I get in coaching and facilitation, like how much I learn about myself. And so I just got into it and I just love doing it and doing it for a certain amount of time. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is that what we do is really unique. And so when people find out about it, they really get into it. So, you know, there's a lot of folks that we know in the content space that I think they, you know, they have like 5 million viewers, but their revenues are very similar to ours, where we have not even close to that, you know, where we like our podcast maybe has 1 million downloads altogether. And we have, you know, like maybe a 20,000 person mailing list or something, but our revenues far exceed all that because what we have to offer is a unique and a very effective approach.
There's so many questions I could ask you about what you just shared. I think because a lot of people listening to this are coaches themselves. And so I think there's some lessons to be shared about what transformed inside of you that allowed you to teach in a way that touched people and had this kind of response. And I've written that down. I want to go there.
Yeah.
But maybe first, maybe I could ask you, you know, you're a highly successful coach, coaching executives around the world, and I think a lot in Silicon Valley, and you're leading these programs. And you just said there's something that makes your work unique. Could you speak into that? What is it that makes your approach unique?
Yeah, I would say there's a couple things about it. The first one is we really think about it in what I would call the three brains. It's not entirely accurate neurologically speaking, but there's the head, the heart, the gut. And so I would say the head is the prefrontal cortex, very human. The heart, I'm calling the emotional life. It's very mammalian. The gut is a very reptilian nervous system thing. And so when we work on transformation, we work on all three levels. And so what I notice is there's a lot of schools that will do one or the other. Oh, we're a somatic approach, or we're a cognitive behavioral change approach, or we're using tools on all three of those levels consistently. Yeah. And so that just makes it really effective, because oftentimes if somebody's stuck in a transformational journey, it's because one of those parts hasn't caught up. You know, how many times have we heard somebody say, yeah, I get it, I should work out, but they're not working out. Right. And so it means that, yeah, their head gets it, but their nervous system doesn't get it. Their emotions don't get it. So that's one of the things that makes us effective. The other thing is that we see business, coaching, any activity in the world, marriage as a self-development practice or a spiritual practice, however you would want to say it. And so there's something that you can get from sitting and meditating. I did it for years and years and years. Still do it. But there's something that you can, there's a way you can fool yourself sitting on a cushion that you can't fool yourself in business. And so there's this very practical thing that we have about how it makes your life, like how you transform your life with it. So that's another thing. I think another thing that makes us unique is how much we are focused on emotions. Not because we think emotions are more important or more true, which is, I think, one of the problems with a lot of the schools of thought is that, you know, I hear a lot of folks who are great emotional practitioners and they dismiss the head. And I'm like, no, the head is fantastic and the emotions are fantastic. But in our society right now, there's a big gap in the emotional understanding. You can read books upon books on, you know, cognitive development. Very hard to find a whole bunch of books on emotional development. We're just getting to the point of these are what emotions are. And by the way, you can do a heat map that shows, you know, as compared to, oh, this is actually how you develop your emotional life develops and how it moves from one thing to another and what emotional fluidity is and how emotions are resisted and how they're transformed when they're loved and all that stuff. And so there's not a lot of people doing that. And so that makes us pretty unique in that space, and particularly in the space of achievement, accomplishment. So, which is what our organization is called, is Art of Accomplishment. And so there's not a lot of overlap in those two areas. And so that's another thing that makes us unique. And the other thing that I think makes us unique is that we don't talk about self-improvement. For us, it's just self-awareness or understanding their authenticity. There's a lot of ways to say it. And so we're really effective because we don't, the way I could say this more easily is I can tell anybody in the audience, there's something that you've been telling yourself to do for a decade that you haven't done, whether it's working out or stop smoking or be nice to your wife or stop losing your temper, whatever it is. And the one thing that I can tell you is true about that is that you're telling yourself you should do it. Or otherwise it would have changed by now. So which means there's some sort of shame attached. And so oftentimes what happens in transformation is somebody gets a new story. They tell themselves what they should do, what they're supposed to do, what they need to do, what they have to do. And that just is a really awful way to create transformation. And so almost everything that we do is antithetical to that. We're like, oh, you don't have to do shit. Like, it's awareness. You know, that list of things that you're building that you now have to do now that you have this epiphany, that's going to destroy the epiphany. So there's a lot of work that we do that focuses on your wants over your shoulds or connection over perfection or awareness over management. And so I think that also makes us pretty unique, but mostly it's just word of mouth. It's just highly effective. We have an online course and we have this ridiculous, I think now we're getting bigger. It's a little less, but we're at like 97 or 98% completion rate for online courses, which is pretty unheard of. So it's just really effective work.
I'd love to sort of zoom in on, there's a lot you just shared there as well. And I think we can start to maybe unpack what it looks like when you bring the head, heart, and gut in together in the work. And I love what you're talking about. Just reflecting on some of the things you said. I know I kind of, as a spiritual practitioner, thought that, you know, having a kind of quiet life on a meditation cushion was going to be the thing that brought me what I wanted and brought healing and integration. And every time I'd get off the cushion and go out in the world, I mean, this is the beautiful thing, is like, that's meeting the world, and the intensity of the world is a radical path of transformation if you hold it in a certain way, which I think a lot of people don't. And so maybe this gets to the other thing, which was, this self-awareness over self-improvement. I was really inspired to, as I was tuning into your work, to see you talking about this, because I think this is like the magic ingredient or one of them. And I'm curious what you say about this inside of transformation, because so many of us are caught in a self-improvement paradigm, which can actually kind of, like you said, it's actually perpetuating a sense of deficiency.
Yes.
Because it's based on these shoulds and parts of it. So I guess the question I'm getting to is, what is at the core of transformation for you? And maybe this points to like what's happening with self-awareness there, and what are you doing with your clients? When you're working with them.
Yeah. The way I like thinking about it is everything living evolves. When is an oak tree good enough? You know, is it good enough as an acorn? Is it good enough when it's a sapling? Is it good enough when it's 20 years old? Is it good enough when it's 100 years old? Is it good enough when it's starting to, you know, fall down? Like, when is an oak tree good enough? And when you see it that way, and then you put yourself as the oak tree, it's nonsensical to think about, when am I good enough? And so many people are on the path feel like if they do A, B, and C, then they will finally be able to be happy. And I played that game for years. So it all comes from, you know, obviously like all of us are my own experience of it, chasing something that never really paid off. And what I find it to be now, looking at it backwards, what I find it to be is a lot of it's depression. So a lot of negative self-talk is then just, you know, it used to be, I'm an asshole for some people. And now it's, I need to meditate more. Right. And so most people would probably know in this audience, you know, low level depression is defined as negative self-talk. So I remember one day going into my meditation retreat and looking around and going, oh shit, like almost everybody here is depressed. You know, I'd never seen that before. They all just look calm, but they're, you know, there's no joy in this room. There's no like love emanating. And so that's something that I know. I don't know if I answered your question exactly, but that's the main thrust of it is we evolve by nature. I remember actually, maybe this is a great way to describe it. One day I was a very odd 20-year-old. So when I was 20, I had a room in a house. This rich guy rented out his rooms and because he wanted a community. And so the house had my room only had like a desk and my bed was in the closet. So it was just a desk in this like beautiful, well-lit room. And I wrote down one day, I was like, I need to be radically honest with myself. So I wrote down everything about myself that I didn't want to admit to about myself. I just wrote it down. And then I put it in the desk drawer and forgot about it. 6 months later, I came upon it. I looked at it and I noticed a lot of it had changed. I was like, oh, wow, change. And then I looked at all the stuff that hadn't changed. And I was like, huh, wow. What do all those things have in common? I was like, oh, all those things are things I'm telling myself I should do. All those things are the things that I'm riding myself to do. And therefore, of course, apply force, get resistance. And so I was resisting. And that was I remember the first recognition of that. Just, this just is ineffective. Even if the voice in your head tells you, like, you'll just be a beer drinking, blah, blah, blah on the couch. If you get rid of me, it's all BS.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good illustration of, how we can get caught in just unaware about how those shoulds are driving us. And so I'm curious, like in your online programs and when you work with clients, is that part of the work then? Are you, they're coming with a particular topic or challenge and are you helping them to begin to develop, cultivate that self-awareness around the inner kind of self-talk and the emotionality that's connected to that?
The way I look at how I do my work is I see the wisdom in them and I speak to it. I don't, helping is not really how I feel my work to be. I'm just finding the part of them that knows, and that part and I have a conversation. And that would be a part of how I do the work. The other part of how I do the work is that I notice that the first three sentences tell me what the whole session is going to be about, typically. That the way they're relating to me is the way that they're relating to themselves. That what's happening in their outside world is a reflection of their inside world. And if you're working on a pattern, you'll see the pattern in every, if you're working on the right pattern, you'll see the pattern in every aspect of their life. So if somebody says, hey, my marriage is fine, but my business, blah, 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 or my business is, blah, my marriage is fine. Yeah, it's never the case. The same thing, the same voible that's happening inside of them is also reflected in their marriage, is also reflected in their business, is also reflected in the way they raise their kids. And so I look for that pattern, and I can see it, and I can verify it because, oh, here it is between us. Here it is in your self-talk. Here it is in your marriage. Okay, that's the pattern. And then I'll call attention to that pattern. And then the part of them that understands and knows already, who knows the next step, then I talk to that. Because it doesn't matter how wise I am or not unwise I am. There's one way to say it, is that the only thing I can do is get in the way. Like the thing, it's almost like coaching is not getting in the way. It would be a great way to say it. I don't know their next step. I might know the route. I might know the pattern. I might see the way 20 people have come out of that pattern. I might be a good road sign, but the next step that's right for them, only they can know. Only they can know. And so I'm talking to them. They're guiding the process. I'm not asking the river to be different than it is. I'm following the river.
Yeah.
And I, as I'm speaking about this, I think all of this, it comes from just a deep faith. When I talk about the oak tree or I talk about this, there's just a deep faith that humans evolve, that humans know, that humans have the same thing that brings geese across the continent brings us to develop and to evolve. And it's far more important that they learn to listen to that than me help them.
Right. Again, there's like three or four questions I could ask, and I will get to them. But maybe what's most alive is, it, what does that require of you as the coach to coach in that way? Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I was hoping we'd get to this question. So there's a couple ways to say the story. There's a book that I read way back in the day by a medicine man named Fool's Crow, and he just talked about the job of a medicine man is to be a hollow bone. That your only job is to clean the tube. It's not to do anything. It's just to make sure that your passage is clear. And so, you know, if people have done a lot of our courses and then they ask us to train them in coaching, we have a program that's off. Like, we don't advertise it or anything. And we'll literally spend the first year just on listening. But we tell everybody who comes in, if you're doing this to learn how to coach, don't like, this is a horrible idea. If you're in this to learn how to be with yourself, to see yourself as you are, to be authentic, then this is a great idea. And we don't even worry about the skill set of coaching, because what we notice is if that's your calling and you're there for your own freedom, you know, there's this great quote from an Amazon tribe and they say, if you're here to help me, no thank you. If you're here to work together for our mutual freedom, then let's get to work. That's really a big part of coaching. I think one of the biggest pitfalls of coaching is, you know, here's the story of a coach. I was in a family. One of my family members was all fucked up. My job was to emotionally take care of them. That's how I got to be who I am. And so now I go around the world and I try to help people. And what I see is that just creates victims. And that's just putting yourself subtly above people. And that's just you being scared of actually being intimate and loving. And so to me, that's the core of it, is that it's just like another way to say it is, it's just another way to, like, coaching is just another way to learn how to love more deeply, more unconditionally.
That's really exquisite. And it points to me to the lifelong dedication of this path, in a sense, and the radical authenticity and artistry of it. Because I feel, you know, there's a danger with coaching as it gets kind of codified into a simplistic set of competencies. And then, you know, on top of that, if coaches aren't mature enough, and so they're still caught in these patterns that are formulated and projecting those out in the world, you know, then this is greatly limiting the capacity of what's possible, especially in our times, you know, where we need this way of meeting one another. So yeah, it speaks to me that it's really essential that we meet ourselves on a fundamental level.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you ever seen any of the rapid coaching that I've done? Like, there's some online.
No, I've seen some of the longer ones, but not, no. I
check there's those. A couple that are, I do this live, people can attend this live rapid coaching every once in a while for the public, but mostly it happens in our courses. And people often think it's magic. You know, what the hell? Like, that just, what, that 15 minutes, that whole thing just went down, or 10 minutes, that whole thing just went down. And it's not, and there's no skill to it. It's like, it's not a skill-based thing. I mean, no skill is an exaggeration. It is so much more about the fact that I am in unconditional love with the person than it is about anything I say or do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a frequency, maybe, or a state that you bring.
It's a way that I relate to myself. It's, you know, state's a weird one, because there's, that implies coming and going, and there obviously states come and go, and I have states, but there's something about this that is more pervasive than a state.
Would you say that the spiritual journey you've been on, and I'm assuming things around that, because, but you mentioned it earlier that you see, you know, business and leadership as a spiritual path. Would you say the spiritual path you've been on has opened up this capacity for you to be in this way?
Oh yeah, man. Before I even thought about coaching, I was very reluctant into this space. It was 25 years. I spent 7 years meditating in a room by myself. I worried about money and meditated. That was my career. Went into debt, sitting there meditating. I did every single psychological, neurological, spiritual practice that I could find. I was constantly running experiments on myself for decades, like 20, 25 years before I even started this work. It's funny because, you know, we have people that we have been training for 5 years who are just starting to coach, and they're like, God damn, that took a long time. And it's like, no, 20 years, 25 years, that takes a long time. So a tremendous amount, all sorts of work, and just very lucky enough to be in that generation where all that work was available and prevalent for the first time. Maybe it started in the 60s and 70s, some of the taste of it came, but geez, we had, hundreds of forms of psychological schools and somatic work and psychedelic therapy, and like we had everything that this generation takes for granted. We were the first generation to have it, and I just went everywhere. And I was fortunate in some ways, unfortunate in others, that had massive authority issues. So I didn't trust any fucking teacher. So I would listen and say, okay, what's the experiment I can run to see if that's true for me? And so I just ran all these experiments. And now a lot of the way we run our courses are these experiments, which is what makes it unique. It's very experimental. There's not a lot of talking, this is how to think or anything like that, because what use is somebody else's wisdom? So it's all, here's some experiments to run, see what you find out.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, I could carry on with that one, but I want to, there's a few things I want to keep, because I think it's this gold. Like, you talked about listening, so, and kind of pattern recognition. How do you teach people to listen, or what's important inside of that? Because I think a lot of coaches listening will be like, oh, yeah. That's the ma yeah, like you said, that's where the magic is. You can get your head full of coaching theories and methods, but that's not the same thing as being in a deep level of perception and listening with somebody.
So I don't know, different people call it different things. You can call it attunement. You can call it listening. What I notice is, and this is an easy experiment you can run, walk out into the world and for a day, listen to everybody like they're numbskulls. And then the next day, especially if it's in an office and you can listen to people the same way, listen to everybody like they are the most wise people in the room. And you will notice the conversations are completely different. What they tell you is completely different. And so how we listen dictates the world that we exist in. So oftentimes people think, oh, the way that you act, if you're confident, then your world will do this and this and this. And if you're meek, then the world will do this and this and this. If I go into the meeting and I do X, Y, and Z, then they will. But very few people are ever going, how am I going to listen in this meeting? As if that doesn't dictate the world that they see. So the first thing is that recognition is how you listen is how the world presents itself to you. And the easiest place to see this is with kids, right? If you're like in the world with their kids, you're gonna get a different kid than if you're listening to the kid, like, how do I get him to do what I need him to do? Like, you're gonna get a very different kid. So that's one of the things about listening. The other thing about listening is that if you're deeply listening, you also have to listen to yourself, which is a lot of what we do as coaches, is that we're listening to ourselves and seeing what reflects inside of us. And if we're really good, oftentimes we'll admit that. I was doing a rapid coaching the other day with a lovely young man who was having a hard time finding any kind of job that felt good to him, and he was being supported by his parents. And it was, I don't know, like 2 minutes into the conversation, I was like, fuck, I'm gonna say this thing, and I don't want to say this thing, which always tells you it's the right thing. And if your heart is open. And I just said, all I can tell you right now is I don't want to be in this relationship with you. Like, this, whatever's happening right now between you and I is like that. This is not where I want to be with you. And in that was the discovery of, like, oh, him trying to pull me in to help him, and how that was creating this victim in him. And then I just called out every single time he was doing it. And then he would just get more and more upright and more empowered as we sat there together. And so So it's that listening. I couldn't have done that if I wasn't listening to myself. I couldn't have done that if I wasn't listening to him. If I was, oh wow, this is annoying. I don't like needy people. I'm going to judge him, which is the reverse. If you're judging somebody, it means there's a feeling you don't want to feel. So if you're in that thing, there's no way you're going to be able to coach that person in the way that, in the way that's like super effective. You're in judgment. Why, like, how is that person going to unfold to you? You're fucking judging me. Fuck off. I'm going to resist you, as an example. Oh, you want to change me? Fuck off. I'm going to resist you. Right? We don't even like trying to change ourselves. We resist that. So it's like, and so many coaches are in there like, how do I change you? How do I fix you? How do I save you? What's wrong with you? Yeah, it's just not effective. Yeah, it's not attunement, not listening.
Totally. I mean, I feel like that's the paradigm. I mean, maybe this is not really mine to say, but it feels like we're moving out of that paradigm a bit of self-improvement where, yeah, those coaches are trying to help improve their clients, and part of that's hooked into their own sense of self-worth and being worth the money, and all it's doing is reifying and fixing the, like you said, it just, nobody changes in that sense. And
Yeah, we're not worth the money.
Right.
there's a game you will never win, worth the money. On some level, obviously, I can justify. I can say, oh, I work with billionaires running multi-billion dollar companies, and one thing that I say to them can create a 2% efficiency in their business, and they're getting a great deal. Like, I can do that math, but our souls know that it's not about the money. And so, if you try to convince yourself you're worth something, there's some way that you always get that soul rebellion from it. And souls, and maybe not the word, but our hearts know that there's this is something we. I would say for. I was going to say, this is something that we would do no matter what, money or not money. If that's not the case for you, Jesus Christ, stop coaching. But if that is true for you, then there isn't a way to justify the money, because you know that you would do it no matter what.
That's important, isn't it? To feel that. I mean, I can feel even just you reflecting that back to me, what that evokes in me, which is that in me, which is the, like, I mean, I love this, and
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So,
I can't not do this,
yeah.
Yeah.
And my experience is if that's the case, the money shows up. I never asked to coach people. Like, that's not how this worked for me. I was never like, I'm going to be a coach. How do I become a coach? What are the, that's not at all what happened in my world. My world was just, I did the thing and then people showed up. And then more and more people showed up.
There's something about this, like underlining that what you just shared with also, yeah, the importance of this being something you have to do, and what you shared about that kind of transformational connection you had with this client. You just, with the rapid coaching where you revealed yourself, and what it was like to be in connection. That speaks to me of a whole different order of practice or coaching than coaching as a kind of professional endeavor that I do. And yeah, there's something alchemical in the kind of feeling of this way of coaching, which creates its potency, it creates a sense of potency.
For both parties. Yeah, I if I'm not growing through the process, this is then something's wrong. I've helped 10 people today. They're all better. I'm drained. That is not good coaching. It's not bad coaching either, but it's definitely not what I'm interested in. It's, I'm interested in, oh, or working together for our mutual freedom.
Do you think it's important for you to be at your developmental edge? And like, I just share that because, like, I know when I coach, there's times where it's like I get a little bit comfortable or something, and I'm not playing full out with my client, in that
Yeah.
full participation. And it's kind of a bit insidious because, like, I'm really committed to not doing that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like I habituate around like my capacity to coach, and it gets a bit comfortable and a bit familiar, and I'm still doing amazing work, but
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not got that feeling of
Yeah.
like being in flow with my clients. Do you find that is do you that's
It's
important?
different. It's in different things, especially with my client list. You're working with a CEO of a significant company. Sometimes my job is just to talk to them about tactics. Talk to them about their sales process. And since I was a venture capitalist for a while, like I can do that, and we can have those conversations, and so that's not me at my edge. But I enjoy the shit out of it. It's quite fun. And sometimes, especially in long-term coaching clients, rest integration is just as important as being on the edge. So when I notice any kind of habituation, that's a little bit of a red flag. It happens from time to time. Oh yeah, I notice every time I'm with this client, I'm in this energy. I'm in a little pushing or a little back or a little I'm trying to convince, or if I notice these little tendencies, these subtle tendencies coming up, then that's important because, oh, okay, I'm now drawn into the relationship they want me to be in, that they've habituated to. What is that? This gives me insight. Let's work on it. Let's address that relationship. But I'm really gentle with myself as far as coaching goes. I don't require myself to be on any edge. What I notice is that the bigger job is to just trust, to just trust what comes out. So if I'm the way I would say it is, let's say I'm playing an instrument. I don't want to think about playing the instrument. I just want to play. I don't particularly care if it's sad or upbeat or funky. Like, as long as I'm digging it, you know what I mean? And I'm not thinking about it too much. And so, and I find it beautiful. And that's really where I spend the time. And so sometimes it's this, I had one, for instance, a session, I think it was, I don't know, 6 months ago, where I just poked the person. I just, there was a lot of depression. They'd been working too hard for too long. So there was a lot of depression. There was negative self-talk, a feeling of stuckness, all which means repressed anger in my language. And so, and they didn't want to get angry. So I just poked them. I think I spent one or two sessions just poking them until they were just like, "What the fuck, Joe?" And I'm like, "Yeah, there it is." So I'm sure there's nobody who says, here's the job of a coach is to poke somebody for two sessions. Or I don't know, was that on my edge? It was uncomfortable to do. I love this person so much, but it was absolutely the thing that was called to do. So that to me, it's a much more about a really trusting the thing that's happening, and trusting that when it doesn't feel right, to be able to notice that.
How do you know the difference between trusting yourself in that way and playing out some kind of
My
pattern? Like,
heart,
you said earlier, like coach.
my heart closes. You can't play out a pattern with an open heart. I'm poking the guy, but my heart's open. If I was poking the guy and my heart was closed, then I'm playing out a pattern. Either his or mine. It doesn't matter which one.
Yeah. And is you said about seeing the wisdom in them as well before, and
Yeah.
it could be easy just to pass over that, and people might be like, oh yeah, cool, seeing the wit, but actually that's, I don't want to do that, like what do you mean by that? And is it the same thing as, and kind of trusting the process and what's showing up? And you've gave this analogy of the oak tree. When is it finished? But what is that to you, like seeing the wisdom in them?
There's literally a physical expression of it, or an emotional sensational meaning of sensation experience of it when somebody you when you see somebody play peekaboo with you, right? Where they're like story, 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 and then they're like, ah, story, 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 story. Ah, here I am, story, story. So there's that. You can actually see when they poke out and they're like, here's the part of me that doesn't believe any of this shit. Here's the part of me that knows that this is a game I've been playing. I literally had this session rapid. This is in the decisions course that we're doing right now. I had a rapid coaching session where I do every Friday on these, and one of the folks, came to me. He's like, "I'm a little crazy. I'm confused," something like that. And I was like, "Cool. So how does this game go?" He was like, "Huh?" I'm like, "What? So you say you're confused, and then what? I come in and try to fix it?" He's like, "Yeah." And then what do you do? And then I kind of find things that are wrong with the way that you're trying to fix it. Okay, cool. And then what do I do? And he literally told me how the entire conversation was going to go. It's like, that's the wisdom. And I could just see him when he was doing his thing. He had like this little elfish smile, this little twinkle in his eye. I was like, oh, he sees, like, he knows this game. And so I could just within a minute say, and he could acknowledge it, and we would go. So I can't entirely explain the cue that I see, but I see it when somebody is looking through their stories for a minute. There's some part of us that, has never been affected, touched, made better, or made worse by any of these stories. And I say that in, and the people listening can immediately get in touch with that part of themselves. Oh yeah, I know that part of myself. And if you say, "Hey, I know there's that part of you, and let's talk," they do it. You don't usually do it that directly, but people come out, they're like, "Oh, cool, let's do that."
Do you think that people over time can start to live from that place more and more? Like, as if the clouds clear, or the things that obscure that clear away.
Yeah, I see it all the time. Yeah, but it isn't what you think it is before you get there. Like, yeah, there's this idea that that's going to be something beautiful and permanent. And in some level it is. It's like definitely beautiful and definitely permanent, but it never ends. The evolution never ends. When the evolution ends, it's called death. Right? The tension never goes away. You just hold it more gently. Without tension, there's no life. Without tension in a cell, the cell dies. Without tension in my lungs die. The tension is part of being alive. Evolution is part of being alive. And, there's this almost religious story about whether you call it awakening or self-development, where you get to this point and it's over. But that's all of that is just a religious ego story. And there's a point in evolution where you learn how to talk, and there's a point in evolution where you learn how to walk, and there's a point in evolution where you don't trust your thoughts, and there's a point in evolution where the voice in your head becomes very quiet. The negative repeating voice in the head becomes very quiet. And it's just growing up. It's n natural. Nothing has to be pushed to do that. You just, like I said at the beginning, don't get in the way. Just keep your tube clear, so to speak.
Yeah, do you think there is a, I love what you're saying here, and do you think there is a threshold where people relate to that tension of being alive in a different way, that it's not like you're now trying to get rid of the tension or have a tension-free life, but you've somehow come to understand that process in a different way.
But even better, you fall in love with it. You're like, yay. Yay, I'm angry. Yay, I'm sad. Yay, I'm scared. Yay, I'm... Friction is here. It's a celebration. It's a love. You see all of it as this outpouring of love and wisdom. Yeah.
That... Because I think there's a lot of fear in the world today.
I don't know if there's ever not been, but yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just aware of it.
Just today we're projecting it out really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you don't mind, there's one thing that I want to say, which is, so when I'm teaching or I'm coaching, I'm never talking about this stuff. I feel like that's an important thing to say. You know, I have like 120 something podcasts in our podcast, and I don't think I've ever, maybe one of them I've talked about this. So it's a really interesting thing. This is almost behind the scenes. This is looking at, you know, the stage from behind, from the backstage. It's in everything I do. It is the way that I do everything, but it's not what I'm teaching. It's felt. Anybody who's done multiple workshops with us understand, like, is that love is felt, that sense of self as awareness is felt, but we don't talk about it, we don't teach it. It's just because it's just the natural unfolding. We don't need to teach it. Teaching it is somewhat antithetical, because then people try to get there and that slows the whole fucking process down.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, that's also with emotions. Yeah. So the same thing when, you know, you say, well, loving, fear, all the different anger, the different emotions. And then the part of me that's like, okay, so I'm going to love fear because actually I don't want to feel it, or I want it to go away.
Exactly.
And like, I've known that for a long time, but as a practice, it's got a kind of almost like an endless nuance to it of, or a subtlety of like, how am I actually subtly trying to make something go away.
Yeah, that I have a phrase is, joy is the matriarch of a family of emotions, and she won't come into a house where her children aren't welcome. And that sums it up. But there's like a secondary part, is like, welcoming an emotion so that they leave is not welcoming an emotion. And it is this, yeah. It's not, that game, I'm not sure, is endless. There is a place where, I think there is an endless, the friction becomes, I don't know exactly. The friction is always there. You just hold it really lightly. At some point, it doesn't feel like resistance.
Yeah, I don't think it's true. It's endless, actually.
It's close to endless. There's kind of endlessness too. It's hard to describe in words. Yeah.
Like recently I started to feel a kind of sacredness inside of fear and anger.
That's it.
And it was like, just like, wow. And it's hard to put into words, really, because it's really a kind of frequency or a felt experience of like opening to that emotion in a whole new order, where it's like, I'm just actually seeing this now for the first time, but it's like loving it. Oh, I get afraid. And that fear that I've been trying to fix.
Yeah.
And now I'm loving it. And it's like, I don't want it, almost like I don't want it to go away. That's such a beautiful thing. So
it is. There's an experience, that one experience people have is, oh, I love this fear. Oh, it went away. This is great. I can love the fear to go away. Wait, loving the fear doesn't make it go away anymore at all. Fucking, what the fuck just happened? And then there's the other experience, which is, oh, I love that fear. Oh, fuck, it's going away. Wait, no, hold on, don't go. That's a different experience, which is quite lovely. I mean, I remember, you know, I had this, our first one was, the second one was just born, and we got kicked out of a house in this very unjust way, or at least it felt unjust at the time. And every time I drove by the house, I was like, what is that? Okay. And so I'd drive by the house on purpose every other day and just feel that tightening and like be with it and just hang out with it. What is this thing? And that curiosity turned into love. And then I would drive by the house and it wouldn't happen. I'd be like, oh, there'd be a missing of it. And I love watching people say, wait, how on earth could I ever love blank, you know, getting angry, being scared, being jealous. And then when they have that moment of, oh, wait, I miss it. I know what you're talking about now. That's like, it's lovely.
I read a Rilke poem just the other day. And man, that guy is such a genius. The way he writes about, like, and I can't, you know, I'm, the don't squander when, you know, the way I would put it is like when there's that beautiful sense of beautiful devastation, you know, your heart is just broken open and you might be feeling lost, grief, whatever is there. But like, he's just saying like, don't squander that. Look her in the eyes and just... And it's that same thing for me of, because there is that feeling of like when it goes away and then it's like, oh no, like there was a disruption inside of that was beautiful.
Another saying I have is that every time we allow our hearts to break, it increases our capacity to love. And when you see that heartbreak is so look forward to, you'd so look forward to it because you know on the other side of it, you can your just capacity to love is so much greater.
Beautiful. There was something I wanted to bring in and it's gone. It might come back, but therefore I'll bring up this thing, and we might have touched into this, but you said, what are the wrong reasons to coach? And maybe we spoke about that already with, you know, helping, getting caught in. But I wondered about that. There was more to share about that because I think it's...
This is really important. So yeah, if you are coaching to help people, that's one. Three or four probably. That's particularly dangerous because you're creating victims, right? You need my help. You're putting yourself above them, which is really not helpful. And you're setting a situation up where you're helping people, which is meaning that they need your help. So helping occurs, but again, it's working together for your mutual freedom rather than I'm helping you. And what that does to you as a practitioner, if you're in that place, is that you start taking responsibility for their transformation, which is you're fucked in that situation. Like, you're not responsible for that. So taking it's going to make you do a whole bunch of incorrect things, but it's also going to have a weight in your life of you're taking on responsibility for things you don't have control over. So, and eventually what happens is what I see with coaches who do that, they'll start acting out in a way to get their own needs met. That is usually dangerous for them and for the client. So that's one that I think is the other. Another one is that false sense of intimacy that I see. Look, I get to coach and I get to be intimate with you, but I don't actually express anything to you. You know, it feels like intimacy, but I'm totally safe. There's no risk in the intimacy. And there are definitely places where I am not vulnerable with students. As a matter of fact, there are places where that's really detrimental to their journey, that they need to project on me a little bit, like I have some sort of perfection, or I'm not anything more than they are. And then there's a time where that needs to be disintegrated. But that's not where I don't get my intimacy from coaching. And if you do get your intimacy from coaching, it's empty calories. It's like a surrogate for love. It's not real. If there's no risk in it, it's not real. And so it creates quite a hollow life. This one's a little more dangerous for the person that you're doing it with, because you're not in an attuned attachment with them. You're in anxious attachment with them. And so that attunement they don't really get to feel your love. So that's another one. Another one that people like that. To be
just to make sure I get that. Are you advocating that actually there is a real kind of intimacy that's needed with coaching, or are you saying, no, you shouldn't try to get that kind of intimacy in coaching?
I'm saying there's forms of coaching and therapy where creating that real intimacy is a great technique. There are great forms of coaching where that intimacy, two-way intimacy, is not needed to be effective.
Yeah.
Great. In either case, don't get your intimacy from coaching. it is not real intimacy either way. And because that's not quite true. There is a way that it can be real intimacy, but that's not where you should get your needs met. You shouldn't get your intimacy needs met in a coaching relationship.
So it's the distinction between the coaching could be real, you know, and intimate in that sense. But if you're doing it to get intimacy that you need, then you're hooked in.
Yes.
And
That's right. Yeah. The other reason people like to be coaching is because they are looked up to. Oh, look, I'm the person who says things and people listen to me. And it's like they're in that narcissistic, even if it's, as my daughter coined this phrase, she said, oh, he's such a gentle narcissist. Even if it's like a gentle narcissistic thing, there's like a narcissism to wanting to thinking that you have something that's more important or more wise. Or, you know, I teach. Oftentimes people are like, that's nonsense. I'm like, yep. They're like, you made that up. I'm like, yeah. Just like Jeff Bezos made up Amazon. Yes, that's how this works. And I could make up something that's different and it can be useful. Meaning it's really useful for a time to think, I have agency. I have choice. I have free will, because it helps me get out of a victim paradigm. It's also really useful to say, I don't have free will. I can't even control the next fucking thought that comes to my head. It's all blessing. It's all surrender. It's all grace. Because then that can help you with any kind of anxiety that you have. Both of those things can be true. And I'm not going to argue with you on which one. That's bullshit. That other thing. Yep, you're right. It is all bullshit. It's like, what's useful right now? As compared to, I want to be seen, I want to be told, I want to show you how advanced I am. I want to, like, that subtle wanting to be seen in it and to have the answers, to be looked up to. That's also incredibly dangerous, because if you're not generous with your admiration in a coaching situation, like, there's nobody I coach that I don't admire on some level. Mm-hmm. And if you're not generous with that admiration, if you can't see what they have to offer because you're there, it's very disempowering for them. And frankly, it's really disempowering for you. It's basically, it really sets up a self-reliance situation. It really sets up a situation where you can't be weak, where you can't be vulnerable, where you have to get angry when somebody attacks you, you're more defensive, like all that stuff, very disempowering. So that's another one that I think is really to watch out for if you're in this business, because people invite you into all of these things. You know, mm-hmm. It's not just, oh, I have the I have that propensity. There's that for sure. But there's also like the clients are inviting you into these spaces. They're like, yeah, please know everything for me. Then I don't have to worry about it. I'll just pay you to make my decisions for me. Ooh, you know? So really watching out for those things is really critical. And all of them hurt. All of them, if you fall into any of them, it will eventually like bite you on the ass for sure.
Right. Yeah, it feels like all of these are like illuminating that kind of power differential that can exist, you know, between a coach and a client. And
yeah, there's a Tibetan, I think it's a Tibetan Buddhist saying that says, if I think I'm better than you, that's comparative mind and that's misery. If I think you're better than me, that's comparative mind and that's misery. If I think we're equals, that's comparative mind and that's misery. I think about that a lot when I'm coaching. I'm not an equal. I'm not better. I'm not worse.
Yeah, I can see how that's deconstructing all of the modes I might be holding.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Have certain spiritual traditions had more of an influence on you? Like, I know you said you've explored a lot.
Geez. I think if one of them had more of an influence on me, it's almost how young I was when I touched it for the first time. You know, the Zoroastrian tradition has not as big of an influence on me because I think it's the last religion I really explored. Yeah. And also the thing about religion, it's like you can say Buddhism, but man, there's just so many forms of Buddhism. You could say Zen Buddhism, but there's just so many forms of Zen Buddhist teachings. You know, there's an old Zen Buddhist. I can't remember his name. It just was so joyful. It was all about joy. And I haven't met a living Zen teacher that does that. Not that there isn't one, I'm sure there is somewhere, but, I've explored deeply many, many of the traditions and many, many forms of many, many of the traditions. You know, there's Meister Eckhart and the Christian tradition is very different than reading the parables of the Bible, you know, so Christianity, Buddhism, Taoism, are probably the ones that had the biggest influence. And they're also the ones that I hit 1, 2, and 3. There's the Sikh book is really, I can't remember the name of it, but that one was quite beautiful. I was dumbfounded by the way that that religion looks today and what that book said was just, it was phenomenal, you know, was an interesting, you know, it was nice to be able to see that the way that somebody might look at Christianity and read the book and go, wait, Christianity looks like what? I don't know the Sikh culture very well, but that book was outstanding. I loved that book. Like especially just the opening pages of it were just dumbfoundingly beautiful. And then a lot of poets too, a lot of poets and a lot of non-dual teachers, but, you know, Mary Oliver, Rilke, Rumi, Hafiz, you know, a lot of poets like that. Jeff Foster, I think, has some good stuff. We whenever we're doing our, these are like off menu in-person retreats, super intense with just like 12 people. We read 2 poems a day. And it's like such a big part of our way of doing things.
Yeah. Such a beautiful way to access a different mode of perception than I think we're often trying to fix and analyze and, And I relate to you about there's so many different types of spirituality or religions. And for me, and this, you reminded me of what I wanted to bring in. You mentioned joy, but the difference between renunciate paths, you know, sutric paths and tantric paths. And then, you know, like Dzogchen, but like what I imbibed a lot were actually like sutric paths that they were kind of saying, you know, well, actually subtly, because they'd been reinterpreted for Western minds, but it was kind of like the message was like, kind of life is going to corrupt you and desire is a bad thing. And, you know, it's, And I struggled with that, you know, my soul just struggled with that. And to find traditions that actually honored the form part of form and formless, you know, because like a lot of Buddhism was like formless, 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 and then a form at the end, you know, like,
especially Tibetan does a lot more form at the end than say,
than say
Theravadin or whatever.
But both together for me and actually enjoyment, you know, a path that was about meeting what's here. And so and you mentioned that word joy, and you said, I can't remember how you phrased it before, but I think you said like joy is the kind of matriarch.
Yeah.
Could you share a bit more? Because I also felt when I saw that in your, I was like, oh, beautiful joy. Here's someone else. Because joy is a moral imperative. That's not my phrase, but like I feel that in these times. Yeah. So could you say more about joy? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot there. Most important thing about joy is I really dig it. As far as I think there's a lot of use to renunciation, and there's a lot of use to embracing the form. I think it's a false dichotomy between the two, that the essence in both of them are the same. I don't know any path that says, okay, let's go get lost in the form forever. And I don't know any path. Well, that's not true. There are some paths that is like, I'm going to renunciate everything forever, but then they never really renunciate all of it. It's not like they're all killing themselves. That would be full renunciation. So I don't know, maybe some weird cults, but so for me, it's interesting. You said joy is a moral imperative. It's lovely. That phrase is lovely in the fact that it twists the idea of joy around, not from a nice to have, but a birthright. It's a little bit tricky of a phrase because it also leans into joy is now a should, you know? Right. So there's a little bit of a, and that's not really going to get you there. So, and so the way I see all of it is there's like, it's a path. And I think, you know, renunciation, it was part of my path, and then that disintegrated. And I'm confident for some people, maybe later stages of renunciation, and because the form part disintegrated. So, but joy in itself is just, it's, at some point you just realize there's really no reason not to be joyful. Like you can't make up excuses anymore. Like, yeah, whatever. I've lost all my money and still, fuck, the sensations moving through my body are so pleasurable. And just, fuck, still I'm just sitting or laying down or standing just like I was when I had the money. Like, and fuck, I'm still alive and my heart is still open. Like, there's just no, at some point, there's just no reason not to be joyful. And I think that emotionally, the way that it works, my experience of the way that it works is for you to not have an emotion, you have to physically constrict your muscles. Like if I say, stop feeling everything right now, you have to constrict muscles to stop that feeling sensation. And so as you stop habituating that constriction of emotions that you weren't allowed to feel as kids, and you start inviting all that stuff up, then the natural sensation in your body is aliveness. So you can call it joy, or you can call it aliveness. You can call it pleasure, call it love. And I could make distinctions there, but there's a way in which all of that starts opening up when you're not resisting life, which is also resisting your emotions or sensations.
I know maybe we should have brought this in earlier, but to tie this to decision making, which might seem like a strange segue, but I think there's something so profound in this and related to So there's something radical in what you're saying. You know, it's like I lost all my money, but I feel radically alive and full of love. And what I want to tie that to is like what I appreciated in what the podcasts I listened to around decision making, which got to something so fundamental to me. And because on the one level, decision making sounds maybe more superficial, but it's so at the heart of being human. And
yeah,
you're pointing to our resistance to making decisions is often related to emotions that we don't want to fear. And so
almost, I would say it a little bit differently.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
So I would say it a little differently. The maybe three ways. The easiest way to say it is, how many decisions have you made to not feel like a failure, or to feel loved, or to not feel rejected, or feel calm? Like, how many decisions are you making just for the emotional outcome? Well, neurologically speaking, all of them. The if your emotional center of your brain gets damaged, your IQ stays the same, your ability to do math problems stays the same, but your decision making becomes deeply impaired to the point. And if, for those who want to geek out on this, there's a book called Descartes' Error, written by a neuroscientist, I think in like 2012 or something. But yeah, so it takes you whatever it is, like 20 minutes to decide what color pen to use or where to have lunch, because it's the emotions that we're trying to figure out how to feel a certain way. We're using logic to figure out how to feel a certain way. And another way to look at this that's really easy is, take the thing that you're most scared of. Let's call it losing your job and being homeless. So you lose your job, you're being homeless, but for whatever reason, I can guarantee you, you will never be happier, more love, more joy. You will feel fucking fantastic. It'll be a heaven that you never knew could happen on earth. Does being homeless, is there a problem anymore? Like the ideas that we think is a problem, like being homeless or losing our wife or whatever, is because of the emotions that we have to feel. And so the more that you can feel those emotions and not be scared of them, the clearer your decision making. And the way that this would work is, say you're having a problem in your marriage and you're scared of losing your wife. You're scared of the grief that you're going to have to feel. And so you feel all that fear, you feel all that grief, you act as if the relationship is already over, you process all that emotion, then there's no problem with losing the wife. And then you act from your truth instead of from the fear of losing your wife. And so the decisions course that we do, which is only once a year and we're just finishing it up, is all about, there's a couple other things, but one of its main tenets is, how do you fall in love with all of your emotional states so that you can make really clear decisions?
Yeah. So do you find that people find that an easy thing to do? I mean, maybe that's not quite the right question, but it's like,
yes and no. There's an arc. Usually it starts off with, oh, this is cool. And then a lot of resistance. And then they find out it's anger that they're not feeling. Then they move the anger and they feel less stuck. There's a pattern that people go through in it. And we even tell people at the beginning of the course, here's the pattern. Like this is probably what you're going to go through. So there's that. But more importantly is, if they do it a little bit, they see the difference. They do it more, they see the difference. They do it even more, they see the difference. So it's really important when you're introducing transformational tools to have tools that you can feel the difference as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And so, because that is the hook that keeps people in the game. And so, you know, we've had people do that decisions course now, for odd reasons. A couple people do it multiple times and they get as much out of it the second time as they get the first time, which really points to the fact that, like, oh, this is not an intellectual understanding game. Like, I can read the science and, but it doesn't change shit, but I can do this thing and I can have this emotional, visceral nervous system experience, and it changes a lot in my life. And then I do it again, and it changes a lot in my life, just the way that, you know, if you work out once, it feels good. If you work out every day, it changes things in a different, more foundational, profound way.
What do you see happening in people? I can imagine there's a sense of people beginning to end a kind of like hedging their bets kind of mode where, you know, you're torn between two decisions and maybe you're trying to compromise because you're afraid if you go one way, you'll lose everything, but you can't stay where you are because then you'll lose out on something you want. So,
yeah. So even that, like, that'll change. So the idea, that assessment starts making less sense because you start to see that that assessment is just, I'm avoiding this consequence, I'm avoiding this consequence. Well, what if I don't avoid that consequence? I'm going to feel that thing because that consequence is just a feeling. So I'm going to go feel that thing, then I'm just going to go feel that thing. And then, well, then what am I avoiding? So the only thing left is to follow my truth, follow what I knew I should have done anyway.
Right.
Right. Which we all know on some level, right? Like a little super easy neurological hack is you have a big decision. You say, oh, 10 years from now, looking back on this, what would I be proud that I made? What decision would I be proud that I made? And, oh, like it just, it's
you just
so clear.
Know it.
Right. Or if I didn't care about the consequences, what would I do? Or if I knew the outcome of both of these decisions would be the same thing, what would I do? And it just immediate, but those are hacks. Where the freedom is to really feel the things that you're scared of and don't want to feel on both sides of the consequences, because then like life just becomes flow. You're just like, it's very rare for me to make, I run a business. I do like, we run basically three different kinds of businesses. I'm coaching world changing organizations, and it's very rare that I'm like, oh, I have to make a decision.
I think that's what I meant by like not hedging your bets. It's like there's just a sense of flow, you know, like
there's not even a sense of a bet.
Right.
There's not even a sense of a bet. There's like, the Buddhists have this thing, mind as wide as the sky, action as fine as barley flour. And what they're pointing to there is, I can see the truth in all the perspectives, but there's only one thing that I could do. Mm. You know, in a Christian way, that would be a you're listening to your calling, or you're surrendering to God or whatever. But when you're in the thing, there's only one choice. If you're really listening, there's not really an option. And so on one level, it feels like freedom. And on another level, it feels like surrender. Because there's no fucking choice. You've done it enough to know that if I go against that calling, it's going to hurt. So I'm not doing that.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So would you recommend people then sit down and go, well, what are the feelings you're avoiding feeling through these different options? Yes, you can hack it through those questions you brought, you know, but the work is really in. So would you recommend people just sit and kind of imagine what would happen in that scenario?
We have a tool that we give to anybody for free called Emotional Inquiry. And that gives you a grand majority of being able to fall in love with these emotions. There's sometimes emotional expression that's very, very necessary to get there. And I don't have a good way to be able to open source that in a way that's safe. So that's something that we do in our courses, but we do like a 5-to-1 ratio when we do it. It's like very cared for and tracked, and we don't do it later stage so that we can really track the person deeply through the process to make sure that whatever attention they need, they get. But so some part of it is that emotional inquiry work, which you can download for free on the website. And then some part of it is about emotional expression done in a super loving environment in a way that will not create more shame. Like there's a whole bunch of things with that, and in a great like a container of love. And because some of it is just muscular, it has to get out. It has to move, and the trauma that that emotional holding got informed. When you release it, sometimes you really, you know, that trauma comes back into consciousness in a way that you'd really need some care.
Yeah, totally. So I'm coming to the end of my time now. So I wish I had a bit longer actually, because I've just really enjoyed hanging out with you, Joe, and pleasure. Yeah, just really appreciate it. So I just want to invite you to share, where can we find out more about what you're up to and the Art of Accomplishment?
Art of Accomplishment, there's a podcast, artofaccomplishment.com. So that's the way to find us. The best way to experience the work is to sign up on the website for the free sessions that we do. There's a free rapid coaching session that happens. And then there's also like mini workshops that we do, because our tools are really unique. And so we want people to experience them before they sign up for a course, so they know that it's right for them. It's the work can be intense, and we don't want people who aren't ready for it. So those are a great way to get a visceral experience for the work. And then the podcast is a great way to get the theoretical, the intellectual version of the work.
Joe, thank you. And I heartily recommend your podcast as well to people listening as well. So yeah, Joe, I just want to say thank you so much.
Total pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches, because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well. And I'll see you again next time.